In 2003, I and some friends, I told them I would teach them the greatest book ever written about emptiness, which is called Gombo Rabse. And it was written by Jetsun Kapa, the teacher of the first Dalai Lama, around 1410 or something. And so we started on that text, which is 400 or 500 pages long. And then, I don't know, we got slightly into it, and I said, you know, let's go read the textbook from my monastery that explains that book, and it will take us about a year, and then we'll come back to the main book and finish it, you know, from the point of view of the textbook from Saramay Monastery, which was written in the 1500s. And so we went off to this textbook called Umachidun, which means an overview of the middle way. And that was 10 years ago, and we never finished it. We're still going through it, okay? So, Jigme, what do you have for lunch? It's been a 10-year detour. We're not even to the main text. By the way, I decided just to start translating the main text anyway. So I'm working on that separately. I think, I don't know how far we're through. I think we're halfway through the commentary. At this rate, it'll take 20 years. But I like it. So not to stress, all right? We have completed discussing the first of 10 bodhisattva levels, okay? So there are 10 levels of a bodhisattva. You reach the first level by seeing emptiness directly. So, I don't know, 3 people have reached the first level in the last 1,000 years or so. Something like that. And we finished the first level, and now we're on to the second level, okay? The second level of a bodhisattva is defined by the bodhisattva reaching extraordinary level of which perfection? Second perfection of the 6. Ethics, ethical life. So someone who's very careful in their moral life, a bodhisattva who reaches the second bodhisattva level has, the reason they reach the second level is that they've now developed an extraordinary ability to watch their morality and their ethical life, okay? But with the added insight of having seen emptiness directly. So the way in which a person who has seen emptiness directly follows their morality and the way a person who hasn't seen emptiness directly follows morality are completely different. Okay? So that's what we're in the middle of. We're in the middle of the discussion. We just started the discussion of the second main part of the emptiness teachings, which is how does a bodhisattva conduct themselves towards other people ethically, in light of having seen emptiness directly. Okay? So we're in the middle of that. And I want to thank Anatole again for beautiful music. Yeah, it was awesome. Yeah. And you can play before my class anytime. You can even play the same song anytime. I don't know how you're going to ever do better than that. So, and I've been translating it as we go. Okay? It was meant to be a translator's class, and we kind of got off the subject. So we're doing a separate video series on YouTube of how to translate Tibetan, and we're filming those segments at Casa Hardin, our center in Glendale, and Nick's working on the videos. We actually need a donation of a computer if anyone's interested. I need one more computer to edit those videos. We don't have enough computing power, and we're behind. So talk to me if you're interested in helping with that. It's a special kind of computer that we need. And I'd like to put it at the center and have people editing videos. We have a series of videos for learning Tibetan, and we have another series of videos for using the database of ancient scriptures. Because a lot of scholars, you know, I've been in many situations traveling around the world. For example, I was in Germany, and a woman came to me who's a Buddhist nun, And she's also a professor at a university in Hamburg, which is a big deal in Germany because it's very, very difficult to become a professor. And to get a PhD is extremely difficult in Germany, and not like the U.S. And her specialty is Vinaya. Her specialty is vowed morality. She was trained by a Geshe very similar to Ken Rinpoche, a very great Geshe from Sarajevo. So she was trained personally for many years, and then she has become a professor. That Geshe passed away some years ago. And so she asked me, could she see me in Hamburg? And she came, we were doing a talk at a business, and she came to the business and they let us use their office for another hour. And she said, look, I've been studying this issue about the nun's vows for 10 years and I need help. You know, I'm not sure what's the answer to this question. I've been looking for 10 years. And she asked me the question, and I said, sit down. I got angry. I said, you sit down, you know. And then I said, look at this ACIP database. It's been out for 25 years now, you know. And here's how you search it for the question you just asked me that you've been waiting 10 years. You've been researching it for 10 years. I said, you tell me if it takes more than 15 seconds to find the answer. You know, I was like irritated at her. And so we found it, and she was like, really happy, because she spent her whole 10 years, her whole career was based on this question in academia. And I said, look, you can just use this thing. What are you doing? Going through these paper documents page by page. I said, you can search 500,000 pages in 10 seconds with Ted Lemon's program. And she's like, well, why don't you teach people to use it? You know, and I'm like, that's a good idea. You know, so we want to put videos on YouTube. So there's two sets of videos we're working on. One is how to learn Tibetan, and the other is how to use the database, how to do basic searches and stuff like that. We filmed, I think, 7 segments. We've only edited, I think, 2. We don't have enough equipment and software to do it properly. Video takes more computing power. So anyway, if you're interested to help with that, let me know or talk to Nick, okay? Here we go. Anyway, eventually we'll put all this up online. So that's going to replace this thing as a class, okay? And then we'll just go through the text, you know? So I'm not pretending that I'm teaching you Tibetan. We're just translating this book together, okay? All right, here we go. I told you the contents of this next section, but I didn't translate it with you. So here we go. Say, follow with me, okay? You'll learn. In Tibetan, there's silent prefix letters and silent suffix letters. Like, you don't say, I know what you want for breakfast. You don't pronounce everything, but you'll figure it out, okay? Automated. 1, 2, 3. Sum ba su chim mi tun cho dang ma de pe. Okay, I'm going to just cut that piece out because smaller pieces are easier to digest for you guys. By the way, this class is supposed to go till 5? Okay, so you don't get a break. That's assumed. Okay, here then is the third section where we given a metaphor, where we present a metaphor for how the bodhisattva's practice of an ethical lifestyle is no longer. Now you find me some. I'm going to ask you guys to help me with English, which is not scholarly and antique, archaic, which is easy to follow for a normal person, okay? So that's a big breakthrough in translating. You can translate it literally, but it will sound stilted and clumsy. and it's difficult for the reader to read. So I'm going to ask you to give me better English phrases, okay? Which is the biggest part of translating. Here it says, the bodhisattva's practice of an ethical lifestyle is no longer depa with a mitunchok. Okay, say depa with a mitunchok. Mitunchok. Depa means mixed up with, okay? Depa means mixed up with. And mitunchok means the opposite of morality. Mitunchok means the opposite. Or so in normal English, we wouldn't say, oh, Rob's a really nice person. His morality is not mixed up with the opposite. You see what I mean? So how do you want to say it, you see? They are going to point out how incompatible this person's lifestyle is with an immoral person's lifestyle. What? Say again? Infected? Sometimes, okay, this is a principle of translation. When you're translating a scripture, if there's already a specific word for infected, you don't use it. And there is. It's called bakpa or bepa. Okay. So if he had wanted to say specifically infected, he would have used that other word. Say again? Enmeshed is okay. The point is that it'll never be adulterated or something like that. You see what I mean? Huh? Diluted means it's still good, but it's watered down a bit. This would mean it's poisoned or something like that. You see what I mean? It's the opposite, with the opposite. Poison's too strong. Huh? What'd you say, intermixed? Inmixed? Enmeshed. Enmeshed is pretty good. It means tied up with, or something like that. What? Just, huh? It doesn't have, it's not necessarily corruption. It just means like milk and water. That's nice. Who said that? I like that. Okay, intermingled. With the opposite of this, of intermingled with the opposite types of influences. Okay, like that. That's good. So we're going to get a very graphic metaphor for how this person's morality, bodhisattva who's seen emptiness, is no longer intermingled with any kind of lower kinds of behavior. Okay? So let's read this together. And I'm gonna take this out, move it here. Okay, let's read this sentence together. Ready? 1, 2, 3. Lu Tsang Da Chen Ne Pe Gya Tso Ro Dang Len Chik Tu Mi Ne Pa De Shin Tu. Okay. What's a Lu? Lu. That's Liu. Lu. Low tone. This is high tone. Lu. Lu. Naga. Naga. Who said? Yeah, Lu means Naga. Okay. Sangdra, you should know, okay? It's a special word. I like words in Tibetan that you won't find in other languages, okay? Sangdra means... but it's also in the Judaic tradition, I think. It means ritual purity, or purity in a spiritual sense. Like the idea of kosher, that you wouldn't mix one kind of animal's product with another, is tsangda. Tsangda means, tsang means clean. Tsangda is a very idiomatic Tibetan that means a practice of ritual purity. So, for example, if you make torma for Vajrayogini in the monastery, you must wash your hands. You must wear a mask when you make the tormas, you know. And, you know, it's not like they think... It's a ritualistic cleanliness. You see what I mean? And then you can be outside and there can be flies all over the place in India and, you know, there's poop all over the ground and that's okay. But you have to show a desire to be ritualistically clean. It's called sangra. Okay? Got it? Okay. It's like the white lab coat that doctors wear that has no function at all. That's sangra. It's just to show that they are special or something. Okay? So sangra. Okay. So Lu Sangda Chen means the nagas of high purity. Okay, the nagas of high purity. Nepa, they stay in the gyatso. What's gyatso? Yeah. Whose name has gyatso in it? The Dalai Lama, okay? By the way, it's his birthday today. And we're going to celebrate it later on today. Okay. Lu Sangda Chen Nepa Gyatso. Ro Dang Len Chik. What's a ro? Ro can mean taste, or it can mean a corpse. Okay, unfortunately, the word is the same. Ro means the taste of ice cream, for example, but it also means a corpse. Okay, which one it means here, a translator has to know from context, right? Okay, if it says he licked the ice cream and it had ro, you hope it's not a corpse. Or if you say after yoga he laid down in a ro. Yeah, in the row posture, you don't think it's ice cream taste. It's a corpse posture, right? Shavasana. Lanchikdu means they don't stay together, okay? So, a corpse, cannot remain. In an ocean which is inhabited by water serpents of high purity, okay. So there are certain, I think naga, in Chinese they call long, it's dragon. You know, I think the myths we have in northern culture, northern European culture, England and Germany, of dragons, I think those are the same beings that nagas are. You know, that they like to collect jewels and gold, and hoard them underground in the huge lairs. This is also a set of nagas. So there must have been, at some point, these beings who did this kind of thing, okay? And maybe they're not around anymore, we just don't see them or something, okay? But also it's said that these serpent beings have the power to attract water, or they live in places which are watery. So like at Diamond Mountain, we have a spring which is just below the surface, and it rarely comes up to the surface. And Geshe Lothar was like, well, why don't we do some naga rituals to bring the naga up to the surface, and then it would start flowing, like that. Okay. So they're believed to have some kind of connection with water. Okay. So there's a class of naga. I checked because I wanted to see, is this a single naga who has the name of ritual purity, or is it a class of nagas? And after many tens of thousands of pages of study, which you can do with the computer, it's a class of nagas. It's a group of nagas, a community of nagas. And they only stay in places, in oceans which are very pure and clean, okay? And they will not stay in other bodies of water, okay? And then they cannot tolerate a corpse being thrown into that ocean. So what happens to that corpse? Yeah, it's literally spit out of the ocean. The waves throw it up on dry land. You see? So, you know, I used to surf a lot, and you would see dead fish, you know, sometimes even like a shark or a dolphin, they will be washed up on the shore, the body of the fish. And in Tibet, it's believed that the Nagas couldn't tolerate a corpse in the water, and they pushed it out of the ocean onto the sand. Okay? Got it? Whew. Why are we talking about that? Why are we talking about that? Yeah, Bodhisattva's mind is so pure. Good. Yeah. Their mind is like the ocean. And there's many connotations there, right? Their mind is wide as the ocean. Their mind is deep as the ocean because they saw emptiness. And their mind will reject filth. You know, so if an immoral thought, a thought to kill an animal, for example, a thought to lie to a person came into their mind, it would be spit out by the ocean of their mind. Okay, got it? It's a nice example. It's a nice, sweet example. Okay. So I'm going to cut this note to myself. The mind of a bodhisattva is the same. It cannot tolerate the presence of, say, sutram, chalwa. Sutram, chalwa. So I think most of you know the word sutram, which is what? Morality or ethical lifestyle. But I don't think you know chalwa. Chalwa means sullied, dirty, mixed up, impure. Okay? Sometimes it means the order of something is confused. Okay? Like that, chalwa. Cannot tolerate the presence of immorality. Okay? The root text uses the following lines to describe this fact. The way in which they keep their morality so pure. By way of a metaphor. Okay? So now we're going to go to the root text. What is the root text in this case? Excuse me? It should be, but it's not. This is a commentary on, well, they're both a commentary on another text, which is what? Yeah, Entering the Middle Way by Master Chandakirti. It's easy to get him mixed up with Dharmakirti, and lots of people do. Dharmakirti is the logician. Chandakirti is the middle way guy. Okay? I think around 600, 800 AD, something like that. Okay? He wrote a book called Entering the Middle Way. And here's the verse, okay? I went and got you the whole verse, all right? Because he just gives a little bit of it. This word nay means what? Huh? That's nay. That's nay. This is nay. Nay. It has two meanings. One is from. Like lay and nay mean the same thing, right? It means from. And then rarely it will mean barley, okay? So 99.9% of the time it's from. But be aware it also means barley. Like if you're doing a fire offering, a homa, and it says use nay, it means barley, okay? Okay, you just got to know that. Right? So he says from this line to this line in the root text is what we're talking about, okay? But I would rather give you the whole verse. Okay, so I'm going to give you the whole verse. Here's the whole verse. Let's read it together. One, two, three. Jidar gyatso rodam senchik dham dashi nanak madham senchik shin tetar tsutim wangche dakni che de chel wadam senchik ne mindu. Okay, jidar gyatso. The ocean cannot, what do you call it when they coexist, right? Stay together with something. Cannot tolerate, the ocean cannot tolerate the presence of a corpse, right? Nor will you ever find. Now this is difficult. Second line up there, okay? Second line up there. What's the first two words? Dashi. Say dashi. Okay, so there's two kinds of teas in Sanskrit and Tibetan. Well, many, but anyway. Say tea, like have a cup of tea. 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 Now turn your tongue back consciously like that and hit the top of your mouth with the tip, with the underneath of the tip of your tongue, the underneath of the tip of your tongue. Have a cup of tea. Would you like a cup of tea? All right. In India, many of the words are retroflex. They require the bending of the tongue. And then if you talk like that, you will sound perfect when you speak Sanskrit. Say cup of tea. Okay, tashi, tashi delay, tashi delay. All right, if you say trashy delay, nobody. All right, tashi delay happens to be high in Tibetan. Okay, tashi delay means hi, good day, how you doing? Okay, say tashi delay, but for the ta, turn your tongue back. Tashi delay. Then you know foreigners go to Tibet and they want to impress the Tibetans and they say trashy delay. And the Tibetan is like, you know, okay, so it's like hatha yoga, okay? Say hatha yoga. It's hatha, hatha yoga, okay? Then you go to India and you say, I'm practicing hatha. And they're like, it's like when I try to speak Chinese in China, and they're like, they know you're trying to say something, but they have no idea what you're trying to say, you know? And so tashi, the root meaning of tashi is here, and it's rare to find it in a book, okay? This is the most common expression in Tibet, tashi delay. And it's rare to find it in a book, but here it is, okay? By the way, in Mongolia, when you try to say tashi, they cannot turn their tongues back to save their life. So if they had a temple called Tashi Gyempo Ling, they would call it Rashi Gyempo Ling, okay? They can't say Tashi. They would say Rashi. Rashi Gyempo Ling. And that's the temple in New Jersey, where I lived for 20 years, okay? 25 years. So Tashi means, how do you want to call that? Tashi means, I'll tell you a Tashi. I was talking to Dennis and Nick about a Sanskrit root called mud. And we spent, like, total together, we spent half an hour on it. And then, because we were trying to understand a word called madana. And I worked with them for 2 days on it, two different days we were talking about it. Then I went to out to dinner with my lama. And we're having dinner in an Indian restaurant. And this really nice waiter, we just interacted with him for like an hour. And then we were leaving, and I said, well, what's your name? And he says, madana. And I'm like, and that's tashi, okay? That's good luck, or that's, what do you call that? It's like serendipity, or it's just auspicious, okay? Tashi means auspicious, like cool, I don't know. Now, my question for you, there's a word after that which is, Nanakma here, Nanakma, which is extremely rare. I've never seen this word. I know it. But Nanak means the opposite of Dashi, and it has connotations of pus and rot and putrid and nasty and black and dark and unhappy and unholy. And so what he's going to say is that if you have a Dashi beginning, you rarely have a Nanakma happen the next minute. Okay, like rarely do they follow immediately one on the other. That the guy says, my name is Madna, and then you drop the dessert or something. Like, it rarely happens. Normally, then you would have another half hour of, like, really good time with him. You see what I mean? So rarely do you have a complete F-up after something really good happened. It happens, but it's unusual. The karma flows for half an hour or something. So how do you want to say that? Nor will you ever find Nanakma with Dashi, you see. What do you want to call Nanakma? He's saying you won't find a corpse in the ocean and you won't find Nanakma hanging, you won't find a Nanakma happening just after a Dashi. That's pretty good misfortune. Happening after what, though? Fortune? I need something nastier than misfortune. Huh? I like that. Who said that? I like that. Let's try that. Nor will they ever find calamity. What's the fancy word in poetry for following on something or on the heels of? Yeah, on the heels of, yeah. Dashi, give me a good word for it. Serendipity? I like that. It goes with the calamity. Okay. I like Dagni here, okay? Dagni Che. Say Dagni Che. Dagni Che. What's Che in Sanskrit? What's big in Sanskrit? Huh? Maha. Maha. Okay? Maha. And what's the word for self or person? Atman. They go together, it's Mahatma. Mahatma. This is the Tibetan translation of Mahatma. It's Dagni Che in this third line at the end. Okay? Dagni Che means Mahatma. It means great soul. A great soul. Okay? Mahatma. Maha. Atma, okay? Maha Atma. So, who's the Maha Atma here, you think? The second level Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva on the second level, okay? Those great souls. Now, for you, maybe Ningbo and a few other people, I want you to struggle with Wong Che. Wong Che. What does Wong mean? Wong. Power or initiation or empowerment, okay? The word che is one of the most common verbs in Tibetan. It means what? To do, okay? To do. The present tense is B-Y-E-D, che. It's cut short. Say che. And you, in the end you go, che. Che. That means present tense. Now here's the past tense. Listen. Che. Che. Okay, so you have to be very sensitive. Your ear has to be very sensitive. I'll say, so you tell me present or past tense. Che. Present. Che. Past tense. Che. 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 Good. Okay, got it? Okay. And there's a reason for that. The past is lingering. You see what I mean? It's very beautiful. So anyway, this doesn't say Wong Che. It says Wong Che. How are you going to translate that? Power. Be careful. Yeah. Oh, you could say that. Yeah. Empowered rather than who have power. Okay? The point is not that they have power. The point is that they are overwhelmed by. Got it? They are powered by something else. They are overpowered by something else. They are at the mercy of their what? Searching. Okay, got it? So be very sensitive. If it had said Wang Che, and which would be easy to mistranslate, you'd say, these are the masters of morality. They have power over their morality. But it's past tense. It's passive. They are the object of the power. So what's it mean? They are overwhelmed by their morality. They have no choice. They are slaves of their morality. Got it? That's a good way to translate it. Yeah. Those great souls who are slaves of their morality, right? Slaves is more extreme, I think. A servant is almost... Anyway, slaves of their morality. It's meant to. Yeah, slaves of their morality cannot bear to live amidst immorality. Okay? Oop. Got it? They are like the ocean that spits out the fish, the corpse. And they spit out immorality. They can't stand it. They can't do it. If immorality shows up in their head, they spit it out. Okay. Expel it. Okay? Now we have to go back and translate the actual text, which says, that this is found in the verse which begins with, okay, then we go take the first part, you see? The ocean cannot tolerate. And continues up to, let me use the last line. Cannot bear to live amidst immorality. Okay? By the way, when this author is, what he's doing right now, he's just giving us a quick overview of the whole chapter about second level bodhisattvas. So he's just saying, okay, it's just this verse that starts with these words and ends with those words. He's not trying to explain the verse yet, okay? He just wants us to know roughly the subject matter of the whole chapter. Alright, here we go. This is really cool, alright? I think, anyway. Let's read these lines together, okay? Just pretend. Make some noise, okay? One, two, three. Shi ba ye wa she ba la te la ye na su chim ki kor sum den me du ngun sum du tok pe Shirab ki ma sinbe jigdenbe tsu tim ki parchindang de simbe jigdenle debe tsu tim ki parchin ni yedo she chepa chepa la. Okay. Here's the fourth point. An explanation of the divisions of morality. Okay? That is the practice of an ethical lifestyle can be divided into two types. A worldly perfection of morality, okay? Which is not imbued with the wisdom which directly perceives that the three elements in an act of morality, none of the is real. Got it? Okay. And two, a transcendent perfection of morality, which is so imbued. Okay? There's a lot of technical stuff here, and you need a lot of training to appreciate it, okay? When you see emptiness directly, okay, it's a 10, 20 minute experience. It takes countless lifetimes to get there, okay? The goal of all the classes we have ever had in my lifetime with you guys is to have those 10 minutes happen to you. The goal of the 3-year retreat, $1 million spent, is that one of those people has that experience, 20 minute experience, you see? When you have that experience, you are in direct communion with higher reality, okay? You live in that. That reality surrounds you right now, but you cannot perceive it. You don't have the karma, really. You don't have that perception right now, okay? In a deep meditation, with much training, with many classes like this, you could come to that 20-minute experience, okay? During that 20 minutes, you are in direct communion with higher reality so that lower reality cannot appear to your mind at that time. It's not possible. So the state of mind in that meditation cannot be mixed with a normal perception of a normal object. Nothing, okay? No normal perception can be going on at the same time as the direct perception of emptiness. And as we said last night, that emptiness is an absence of something. It's a negative, okay? It's an absence of something. So it's like you're in... it's as if your mind were in crystal or inside of a diamond or something. There's nothing there. It's just a kind of absence. Clear, light, okay? And so during that time, you cannot have any kind of normal perceptions, okay? Including an awareness of whether or not what you're doing is moral. Okay? You cannot have a moral sense going on during the communion with God, okay? It, of course, you have to be moral for countless lifetimes to get that communion with God. But during the direct communion with God, you cannot be thinking about whether what you did yesterday was good or evil, okay? You cannot have a awareness of ethics going on in your mind while you're in the direct perception of emptiness, okay? Then there comes this argument in Buddhism, you know, well, what happens to that bodhisattva's awareness of morality? Are they suddenly morally, what do you call that? Is their morality suspended for those 20 minutes? You know, where does their morality go during those 20 minutes? Because it's not possible for them to have a consideration of whether something is moral or not during the direct communion with God. Okay, it's not possible. It can't happen. They can't have a question come in their mind, oh, I wonder if it's okay that I took Scott's coffee off the table without asking him while he was busy. You see, I mean, they can't have a thought like that going on while they're in the direct communion with emptiness, okay? So the question comes up in Scripture, for that 20 minutes, is their morality suspended? What happens to their morality? And the answer to save you a year of work, the answer is their mind is imbued by that sense of morality, okay? Their mind is like soaked in their sensitivity to the morality of something, but they cannot have a direct thought about it, okay? Got it? So we distinguish between having your head soaked in morality and pondering an ethical question. Okay? During the direct perception of emptiness, you cannot ponder an ethical question because that's deceptive reality. But you can have your mind soaked or under the influence of, like in driving, what do you call it? DWI? Driving while under the influence, right? The Bodhisattva's mind is under the influence of two things really, compassion and a sense of morality. But they can't have a conscious thought about it during direct. Okay? So we say imbued with. Okay? Got it? And the opposite as well. Okay? While this second level bodhisattva is observing their morality. Okay? Like I have, I don't know about what you have in your house. I'll tell you what happens in my house in Rimrock when it gets over 100 degrees inside for like 3 days. Which it did recently. These little tiny black bugs come out. I don't know from where. I don't know what they do. They don't seem to have anything to do. They can fly. If they're desperate, they can fly short distances. They don't bite you. They just hang out. Hundreds of them. And then when the temperature drops back to 95, they all disappear. I don't know what they are. I was going to look them up online, but what are you going to look for? A little black bug? You know, I don't know. Maybe somebody... They're not kissing bugs, okay? They're just irritating little guys. Why? I don't want to kill them, you know? Like, I can't wash the dishes. I have to pick them out of the sink one by one. Then I start washing the dishes. Then there's another one flies in there, and I have to stop washing the dishes. And, you know, it's irritating. They're too small. You get the least bit upset at them, they die, you know? Like, you're like, get out! You know, you're like, no, no, don't die. You know, and you know, it's like really frustrating. So that bodhisattva is struggling to be moral. You know, is it okay? So one of them got down the sink. Is it my fault? Do I have to not wash the dishes till tomorrow morning and hope that he gets out? You know, like where does my responsibility end for this guy? I mean, he's the one who chose to go down the sink. You know, I'm just trying to wash the goddamn dishes, you know. And I already picked 100 of them out of the sink. You know, so where does my responsibility end? You know, while I'm pondering this question, I cannot be in the direct perception of emptiness. It's the opposite of what we just said, okay? My mind can be what? By the direct perception of emptiness. It can be soaked. It can be under the influence of having seen emptiness directly in the past, okay? But while I'm worrying about the little bug who just jumped down the sink, down the drain, you know, while I'm worrying about that, I cannot have the direct perception of emptiness, okay? Can my mind be under the influence? Yes, okay? It's the opposite of what we just described, okay? Whew. Okay. Go ahead. Oh, we're discussing a second level bodhisattva. We're discussing a second level bodhisattva. Oh, because we are charged at this moment in the text with dividing out all the possible kinds of morality that there are. And he says, you know what? There's only two kinds of moral behavior. One, by a person who has seen emptiness directly. Two, by a person who has not. And that's it. There's only two kinds of ethical behavior. Either you've seen emptiness directly and your morality is informed by that, or you haven't seen emptiness directly and your morality is not informed by that. The second kind of morality is called worldly morality. The first kind of morality is called transcendent morality. And that's all. And we had a reference in the Lamrim. They said all the actions of a moral person in their whole lifetime cannot equal the moral actions of a person who's seen emptiness for an hour. You see what I mean? It's totally different power. Completely different power, okay? So he's trying to encourage us what? I mean, obviously be moral, but try to do it with emptiness. Try to understand emptiness, okay? In a very simple way, in an understandable, what do you call it? Conceptual way. How would their morality differ, okay? We can go back to the last night's kitchen, okay? We can go back to the kitchen. You walk in from work. Your partner attacks you with no apparent reason. You know, you walked in, you set down your bag. You didn't set your down your bag yet. And they're already on you. They're already criticizing you, right? It would be moral not to respond, okay? It would the same. It would be moral not to respond with anger or with criticism, okay? And there could be two motivations for that morality, okay? There could be two motivations for that morality. An untrained person who never heard about emptiness, they will say, it's not nice to say bad things. It hurts me to be criticized. So the last thing I'd want to do would be to criticize them back and hurt them. I feel how much it hurts me when someone criticizes me. So, of course, morality means not to hurt other people. Why would I want to do it back to them? I won't respond. I will try to keep my peace, okay? That's a worldly morality, okay? What's a higher morality? I won't respond because what? Yeah, because I'd just make another one. You know, it's more intelligent morality.